We are absolutely delighted to be here today to sponsor this talk by Neil Ferguson, the storied, famous historian, I'm told, the author of no fewer than 16 books, one of the giants of today's firmament. He's talking today on the world today in historical perspective, which is really the essence of history and how to understand today's issues and how history is being formed really all around us. And there's a lot to talk about. I am not going to take up any more of your time, except to say at the end of this talk, he will be signing books, his latest book called, rather entertainingly and optimistically, called Doom. He will be signing it in that Waterstones. So please go to that Waterstones. If you go to that Waterstones, he will indeed be doomed. And that's really it. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Neil Ferguson.
Well, thank you very much, Neil. It's a great pleasure to be with you all. I have bad news. We are studying the wrong subject. We're reading the wrong books because we chose history. But just a few days ago, a guy named Mike Solana, those of you in the tech world will know that name, tweeted, "We're living in a science fiction novel." And Elon Musk replied, "Sure seems that way." And they're right. We're all living in a science fiction novel. Imagine if 20 years ago, you had picked up a novel set in the year 2025. And in the year 2025, the novel told you Donald J. Trump is president of the United States. That's the host of The Apprentice 20 years ago. And he's just sent invisible B-2 bombers to drop 30,000-pound bombs on a nuclear enrichment facility in Fordo, Iran, each of which exactly hit its target. Not only that, but those who were skeptical about the veracity of this story then went to artificial intelligence chatbots to make sure it was true. These artificial intelligence chatbots existed in a significant number of different variants, but the most popular one was called ChatGPT. It doesn't stop there, the science fiction. The most dynamic economy in the world in this future 2025 is Argentina. And the president of Argentina has an enormous bouffant hairstyle and is known affectionately in his native Buenos Aires as El Loco. By this time, you as a serial history reader are tossing the science fiction book aside dismissively, saying to yourself, "This is just too absurd." We are living in a science fiction novel. The only question is, who is the author? How many people in this room have read a novel by the author Neal Stephenson? So that's about 7 hands. So 7 out of, I think it's 900 people this tent holds, is a small percentage. Because you all read history. The problem with history is that it's very bad at encouraging you to imagine technological change. But the thing that's probably most important for us to understand is technological change. About six years ago, I suddenly realized that I'd stopped reading science fiction at the age of about 17. It was because I found Isaac Asimov unreadable. And I rarely gave up reading books as a boy. I would take five home from the Air Public Library and digest them. But with Isaac Asimov, I drew the line. Because Asimov's books are really badly written. This was a mistake, because one of the interesting things about the Foundation series of novels is that Asimov imagines a discipline called psychohistory, which, with the technology of the future, is able to predict history. Predicting history is an important skill to have if you can acquire it. But I never read those books and never heard of psychohistory until about 6 years ago, when I realized that I hadn't read enough science fiction and I had read too much history. So I told the young people, as I'm going to tell you, at my advisory business, Greenmantle, named after the great John Buchan novel, you must start reading science fiction as well as history. Because you need to attune yourself to the probability of rapid, non-linear technological change, as well as to understand the patterns of the past. And I took my own advice. So I began reading Neal Stephenson's extraordinary novels. Snow Crash. Snow Crash, written in the early 1990s, coined the phrase the metaverse. In Snow Crash, everyone in 2020s California lives about half their life in the metaverse, where their avatars, he uses that term too, have a much better time than they do in the real world. Then I read Cryptonomicon, which foresees the dramatic transformations of cryptography toggling back and forward between our time, or at least the time when the book was written, and the time of Alan Turing. Stevenson is an astonishingly gifted writer. And if I achieve one thing on this sweltering afternoon, it's to persuade all you history buffs to add science fiction to your reading list, like the seven people who have read Neal Stephenson. Because we need to remember that we in the present, we're the connective tissue between the history and the science fiction. And we therefore need to read both. Because this is a history audience, I'm not going to belabor the point. What I now want to suggest to you is that we can't understand this world of artificial intelligence, of reality TV presidents, of plans to colonize Mars, because remember, in the science fiction novel written 20 years ago, about 2025, a guy named Elon Musk is planning to colonize Mars with massive spaceships far larger than anything built in the Apollo program. You can see how fantastical this novel is. I want to talk about history. And it's odd to talk about history here in Chalk Valley, because as far as I can see, no history has happened here in over 1,000 years. It's actually quite remarkable that the only time that Wiltshire is mentioned in David Hume's vast History of England, which, by the way, is one of the greatest history books ever written. One of my former comrades at Magdalen College, Oxford, is here, sitting on the front row. They made us read Gibbon, didn't they, Tiffany? Gibbon. But Hume is much better than Gibbon. Hume is much funnier than Gibbon. And that's saying something, because Gibbon was a witty writer. But David Hume's History of England is one of the most brilliantly written books in all the English language. urge you all to start reading it. It's just delicious. The chapter on the Crusades alone will make you laugh out loud. It is an absolutely wonderful opening series of paragraphs. Hume mentions Wiltshire once in the whole of the history of England in connection with a battle that happened in the year 825 when Egbert of Wessex defeated the Mercians. That's it. No history has happened here since then, except the Chalk History Festival, which is the only other thing that comes up when you ask ChatGPT about Chalk Valley. I want to try and show you how I think about the world. I guess it was just over a week ago. Yes. Neil and I were at an event organized by the Times newspaper, for whom I now write a regular column. I mention that because they're not sponsoring this event, and clearly they should be. We were at an event, was it Thursday of last week, so 9 days ago. And I said, the United States is going to bomb the nuclear enrichment facility at Fordo. I said, I think that decision has already been taken. And I think the only question is whether the Iranians retaliate by closing the Strait of Hormuz, in which case every business represented in this room has a problem, or not. And many people were subsequently quite surprised that that prediction proved accurate. And just a few days later, a week ago, it happened. So I want to talk about how I think about history as a way of connecting what we know about the past to the science fiction piece that we can't easily infer from history. Because what I now do for a living is applied history. Applied history is trying to discern the historical narrative in real time, which is what Asimov has in mind with his concept of psychohistory. There's no way of modeling the historical process in the way that social scientists have tried for many decades to do. It's too complex to model. And the models, the most sophisticated models are in macroeconomics, don't work. The Federal Reserve is a tremendously complex macroeconomic model. It's consistently wrong about what the US economy will do. And this is because the historical process is characterized by extraordinary complexity, non-linearity, chaos effects, concepts that have inspired a lot of my work over the years. So in order to try to do history in real time, you can't expect to model the process. What you do is you engage in a kind of pattern recognition. Another person they didn't make us read at Oxford, whom they should have made us read, was R.G. Collingwood, an Oxonian. Put your hand up if you've read anything by Collingwood. So Michael Gove is one of only three people in this tent. Well done, Michael. Kudos to you. In this tent, who read the single most important philosopher of history to have been produced, in my view, in the English-speaking world. Collingwood says, he wrote a brilliant autobiography published in 1939, that history is, I'm going to paraphrase, the reconstitution of past thought from the things that people leave behind, mostly documents, but not only documents, because Collingwood was a keen archaeologist. The reconstitution of past thought, which we then juxtapose against our own present thought in order better to understand the dilemmas, the problems that we in the present face. And that is the best definition I know of what I do, of what applied history is. We're juxtaposing the very different worlds of the past, comparing those worlds, those thoughts, with our thoughts. Collingwood says the historian is like a woodsman, an expert tracker, whose ability to discern historical patterns distinguishes him from others. He says in a very lovely turn of phrase, the traveler looks around in the wood and sees grass, but the historian sees the tiger in the grass. I want to give you a few examples of pattern recognition through historical juxtaposition to try to show you how I arrive at my view of the world at any given time. And then, because it's jolly hot in here, I'm going to make you do some work by asking me difficult questions. I actually enjoy the question part much more than the holding forth part. In the future, historians will probably write more about artificial intelligence when they write the history of the 2020s than about Donald Trump. This is a challenge for journalism, a profession well represented here. It's often said that journalism is the first draft of history, and I have done much journalism in my life, but I've come to realize that that's not right. Journalism is the wrong draft of history. Journalism nearly always gets it wrong because of the proximity of the events and the incentives that motivate journalists to make people read their stories. Much of history is boring but important. And this makes it inherently unsexy. It's hard to explain exactly how a large language model works. And if you try to explain how a quantum computer works, you lose just about everybody who started reading the article. So journalists concentrate on that which is readily intelligible. And the career of Donald Trump is readily intelligible as a kind of made-for-TV drama, sort of Dallas meets the West Wing. But artificial intelligence is much more important. If you think about the economic history that lies ahead of us, the great question is, will it destroy the jobs? As a good starting point for thinking about this, read David Landis's Wealth and Poverty of Nations. As you will have noticed in a rather Oxford Don way, I'm giving you a reading list. And I'm hoping that at least some of you are taking notes and not just checking email. Landis's Wealth and Poverty of Nations is probably the single best economic history of the world that's been written. And I was asking myself, what would David say about AI? He died long before the advent of ChatGPT. And I think David would say, every time there's a major technological advance since the Industrial Revolution and even a little before then, people have said it will lead to large-scale unemployment. And they've always been wrong. And the question is whether that still holds. Are large language models essentially not different from, say, the internet, or for that matter, mechanized cotton spinning and weaving machines? I think the historical answer goes something like this. In a long run, 10 to 20 year time frame, there almost certainly will be increased employment and economic activity as a result of these technological advances. But in the short run, there will be just the kind of dislocation that we saw when agricultural employment in places like Wiltshire was suddenly destroyed by the advent of mechanization. So history tells us to expect short-term shocks before the later adjustment. Think the 1820s. I will predict here and now that the artificial intelligence shock to white-collar employment, that is to say, the employment of people with university degrees, will be comparable in its magnitude as the shock caused to working-class or manufacturing jobs by China in the period after 2001. What nobody can tell is what the cultural and political consequences will be when hillbilly elegy comes to the people with the degrees. We might be getting a little foreshadowing of it in New York politics right now. I'm fairly sure the people who went to university, when they feel very disappointed about not getting jobs at the hyperscaler tech companies, won't become MAGA supporters. That seems unlikely. This is the kind of pattern recognition I think it's important to do. It tells us that we're probably underestimating the short-run shock that AI will cause, in the same way that in 2001-2, just about everybody underestimated the consequences of admitting China to the World Trade Organization, which had an absolutely disastrous impact on manufacturing employment throughout the developed world. Second question, what will be the cultural consequences of the artificial intelligence age? I don't need a crystal ball to answer that question. I can see it already in high schools and universities all across the United States, and I imagine it's true here too. Within just months of the launch of ChatGPT, 90% of US undergraduates were using it. And they were not using it as a search engine. Oh no, that's what oldies like me do. The Generation Z student uses ChatGPT to avoid reading, thinking, and writing, often thought of as important facets of university life. Even at Magdalen in the 1980s, we did feel that we should do some reading, writing, as well as occasional thinking in between. Today, in most educational institutions that use any kind of technology for the production of schoolwork, the essays are all being written by ChatGPT, virtually all. And so already an educational disaster is unfolding in which a generation will not learn to read anything of any length, to think about it in an analytical way, or to write about it in an intelligible way. Because these things are all done by large language models better than most students can do them for themselves. The large language models can never be original, but they can be better, significantly better now than the average human. No one knows what the consequences will be, but I had a conversation with my old friend Jonathan Haidt just a few months ago. As you know, Jonathan's written very well on the disastrous effects of mobile phones and social media on kids. You should never give children phones. Don't do it. Don't give them phones. But this is worse. If you thought the educational impact of COVID was bad, AI is two orders of magnitude worse. We are creating a new generation of barbarians, of people who don't really know how to think, who, if you ask them to read War and Peace, would need post-traumatic stress therapy. And everybody my age, and I see this all over academia, is underestimating this. I'm a founder of a new university, the University of Austin in Texas, because I came to the conclusion that the established universities will never reform themselves, certainly not in my lifetime. And I have said that at our university, there will need to be a cloister, a technology-free cloister, where the students will have to spend 6 or 7 hours a day with no access to any technology, access only to books, paper, and pens. No other university will be able to do this. All the others will contribute to a massive generation-wide neurological disaster. To understand what it is to lose the power to think, it helps to go back to Keith Thomas's wonderful book, Religion and the Decline of Magic. When Henry Kissinger was introduced to AI at a Bilderberg meeting years before ChatGPT, I think it was 2016 or 17, he heard Demis Hassabis speak and immediately saw, brilliantly, that AI would be like a return to the pre-Enlightenment or even pre-scientific revolution world, because things would be happening that we could not explain. magic. Magical thinking is already flourishing as we become less and less able to explain the world around us. So it's good to go back to Thomas's book and realize that that historical process he described, the process whereby rationality drove out magical thinking, is currently going in reverse. And we are returning from an age of reason to an age of magical thinking. And it's happening much faster than most of us realize, because we don't realize how magical the thinking of young people has already become. I want to talk about two more things and then go to the viva voce stage of the exam. I've consciously left Trump until the end because everyone talks too much about him. And most people on this side of the Atlantic don't remotely understand him. Indeed, most American professors don't understand him either. And it's hard to know who has the worst case of Trump derangement syndrome, Europeans or American academics. My friend Tim Snyder at Yale has fled the country to Toronto to escape the coming terror. If any problem should lead you to the solution, move to Toronto. What the Germans call die Fragestellung, the way you have posed the question, may be wrong. I love Canada, don't get me wrong, Canadians. Trump is not Mussolini, much less Hitler. One of the stupidest category errors of the last 10 years, which has been repeated again and again and again in bad op-eds, again and again and again, is that Trump is the American Hitler. This is extraordinarily stupid. And I say this as somebody who used to teach the Third Reich special subject at Oxford for many years. If I had a time machine and could take you back to 1933, specifically to Berlin in 1933, you would immediately see the difference. Certainly if I took you back to Berlin in 1938, you would see the difference, because by then, just about every man would be in uniform of one sort or another. Fascism, Nazism, were primarily militarism. That was their main raison d'etre. And of course, utter lawlessness. Trump is not in any way connected to the fascist dictators of interwar Europe, because he's recognizably in the American tradition of populism. Every aspect of Trumpism has an American antecedent, the nativism on immigration, the belief that tariffs are a beautiful thing, a source of revenue, a bargaining chip, a way to protect your industry. The idea that monetary policy is too tight and should be looser. All of this comes straight out of the late 19th century Gilded Age. When President Trump was trying to explain himself to incredulous reporters who still didn't realize he was going to win a year ago, he kept mentioning William McKinley. There's a reason McKinley was the president he referenced, because McKinley in the House of Representatives was tariff man. So Trump is in fact straightforward to understand because he is deeply rooted in 19th century and specifically late 19th century American politics. Just as the Trump era represents also the return of the machine to politics. Just about every state and just about every county in every state has a predictable election outcome. The election of 2024 was decided not just in seven states, but in a handful of counties in those states. You only really needed to spend a weekend in Northampton, Pennsylvania, to see that Trump would win. I sent one of the Green Mantle people, a highly sophisticated young Democrat, I said, spend the weekend in Northampton, tell me what you see. She came back and said, I can't really tell who's going to win. I said, tell me more. We finally got to this key detail. The billboards are all for Harris. The signs in the yards are all for Trump. That's all you needed to know. That told you he was going to win. So to understand Trump, forget the Snyder view that somehow the United States is teetering on the brink of 1933. If it is 1933, it's 1933 in America, and Trump is in some ways imitating not William McKinley, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt. No president since Roosevelt has passed that many executive orders in the first 100 days of his presidency. To find a comparable period of frenetic presidential energy, you need to go back to 1933 in America. There are other interesting analogies too. And this brings me to the last thing I want to talk about, which is foreign policy. Geopolitics, a phrase that has become fashionable amongst people who have never read Mackinder, Spikeman, or any of the other people who actually defined geopolitics. Trump owes a surprisingly large debt to Richard Nixon. And that shouldn't surprise us, because Nixon was one of the first people in American public life who took Trump seriously as a potential political player. They met in the early 80s. Nixon was a faded, extinct, practically extinct volcano, trying to salvage something of his reputation as an elder statesman, and Trump was a real estate guy on the make. But Nixon, and especially Pat, his wife, saw the political potential. And Trump's debt to Nixon is, it seems to me, something that is understated in the coverage. Think of what Trump has done since his re-election as a repeat in altered form of 1971. The summer of 71, the summer of the Nixon shock, Nixon did two shocking things designed to shock his allies as much as his adversaries. The first, he announced he was going to meet Mao Zedong in Beijing. That was July, which threw the Japanese and the Taiwanese especially and the South Koreans into complete confusion, not to mention the Soviets. A month later, he announced that the dollar was going to sever its link to gold, depreciate, and a 10% tariff would be imposed on America's trading partners. Does that sound familiar? Because it should. Trump's shock has taken two forms. One, a geopolitical shock, which was mainly administered by J.D. Vance in Munich in February. And the shock was, if you Europeans don't do something serious about your own defense, NATO is over. This shock worked so well that European leaders, kneeling before Trump, pledged to increase their defense budgets to 5% of GDP this past week. Pre-Trump, most of them were spending less than 2% of GDP. And the other shock has, of course, been the tariffs. I hated the tariffs. I hated the tariffs because the reciprocal tariffs announced on Liberation Day very nearly blew up the bond market. And I'm kind of sensitive about that. I mean, I like the bond market not to blow up. And you should too, because a really large part of your savings is invested in the bond market. So the Liberation Day thing freaked me out. And it was very stressful until lunchtime on April the 9th when Trump was persuaded by Scott Bessent to postpone the tariffs. And then we realized, oh, the trade war is a phony war. It's all going to be fine. Because the phony war was the prelude to the real war. And this is the final point that I want to make. What just happened owes more to Ronald Reagan than to Richard Nixon, much less William McKinley or Franklin Roosevelt. After 4 years when American deterrence was eroded by a series of disastrous errors by whoever it was who was running Joe Biden's administration, we're still really trying to work out who it was, deterrence has been restored. Surgical strikes are back. Americans love surgical strikes. You know why? Because American surgeons are really good. So they have a quite positive view of surgery. And they also really like short-term interventions rather than multi-year interventions in faraway countries of which they know nothing and could care less. Surgical strike is the perfect solution to the American desire for power without commitment. And it works remarkably well, just every now and then, to remind everybody else that the United States military is overwhelmingly superior to the competition in every domain. It's not just that Iran has been humbled, that the regime in Tehran is on its knees. More importantly, Putin is rocked back on his heels because not only did Syria go, but now it turns out the Russian air defense systems are so useless, there are no protection at all, even against the Israeli Air Force, much less the US Air Force. And in Beijing, what is Xi Jinping thinking? Does invading Taiwan seem like a better idea or a worse idea today than it did a week ago? I leave you to answer that question. To understand the world today, we have to understand that we're in Cold War II, and we've been in it since probably Xi Jinping's coming to power in 2012, and certainly since Donald Trump's election in 2016. That was the beginning of the moment when Americans realized the challenge that they faced. Cold War II will reach a culmination in the next 3 years. The culminating issue will be Taiwan, and I just can't tell if we're going to have a Taiwan semiconductor crisis as scary as the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. All I can give you is a probability, and the probability is that roughly 50% there will be a Taiwan crisis between now and the end of Trump's presidency. Because Xi Jinping doesn't have long. Xi Jinping is not a well man. Dictators who want to leave their mark with health problems are in a hurry. He also knows that the next president may be less willing to cut a big, beautiful deal. Donald Trump, who told John Bolton during his first term that as far as he was concerned, Taiwan is a Sharpie. He took out a Sharpie. This really happened. They were sitting in the Oval Office. It's one of the great scenes in Bolton's book. And they're talking about Taiwan, and Trump goes, John, you see this Sharpie? And Bolton goes, yes, Mr. President, I see the Sharpie. You see the desk, John? And he taps the resolute desk, the great big desk in the Oval Office. He said, the Sharpie is Taiwan. This desk is China. I'm not sending the U.S. Navy across the Pacific to fight a war over a Sharpie. There's no guarantee that the next president will be quite so ready to deal on the Taiwan issue. We as historians have to live at the junction between the past, between history and the future science fiction. Certain things don't change. That's why we can understand Thucydides. When we read the history of the Peloponnesian Wars, we read the Median Dialogues, and we read the strong will do what they must and the weak will do what they can and the weak will do what they must, we get it immediately. We don't need anybody to explain it to us. We can read and understand Shakespeare. We can understand love, jealousy. It's not difficult. Even although the language has changed, the underlying human emotions are recognizable. Much of the human condition is unchanging. But the technology, that does keep changing, and it changes ever more rapidly. That is the challenge that we face. I'm going to end with Tacitus. 4 or 5 days a week, I wake up and I think it's going to be okay. Constitution was designed by applied historians like Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. And they knew that somebody like Trump would become president one day, and they designed the Constitution so that he wouldn't be able to turn the Republic into a monarchy and then a tyranny. And they knew what they were doing, and it's working. 2 days a week, I wake up and I think, this is what it must have been like in the late Republic, somewhere between Octavian being called Octavian and Octavian being called Augustus. I told you that technology was unpredictable. I wasn't expecting an enormous diesel engine to start up just at my peroration, but it happens. Tacitus tells us in the annals that Augustus and Tiberius didn't seize power. It was given to them by corrupt elites who no longer felt the constitution of the Republic needed to be defended. 2 days a week, I worry about that. 2 days a week. But the rest of the time, I'm basically, this is awesome. Thank you very much indeed. All right, I said it would take, I've got 18 minutes according to this clock of questions, and apparently there are yellow cards that point to the question asker. There's a lady there with a yellow card above her head. Yes, madam.
Hello, thank you for a wonderful talk. Speaking of leaders who, with failing health, are in a hurry to leave their mark, what do you predict Putin's actions will be before the end of the Trump presidency?
I think Putin's health is better than Xi's, unfortunately, because it would solve many problems if Putin were to die. He's also very much harder to assassinate than Supreme Leader Khamenei, who was nearly assassinated just the other day. So we have to reckon with Putin for the next 3 years. Things have gone really wrong for him, as I mentioned earlier. The thing that has gone most wrong is German rearmament. There isn't a Russian alive who doesn't hear the words German rearmament and feel a little bit sick. And although Friedrich Merz doesn't look especially like the stereotypical German militarist, do not underestimate a massive increase in German defense spending as a strategic disaster for Putin. It's not like NATO can become independent of the United States, but we just had President Trump reassure us that Article 5 will be upheld, and NATO is in better shape than I thought it would be back on election night in November. The Europeans got the message. And I think Mark Rutte was right. Daddy's back. And as long as you respect Daddy and remember Daddy pays most of the NATO bills and Daddy provides nearly all the nuclear deterrent, then Putin has a problem. I spoke this week to Dmytro Kuleba, the former Ukrainian foreign minister who's become a friend, and he said, Putin, while you were busy watching the Middle East, has started to target civilians. He believes he can break our morale. But it's actually a sign of his desperation that he's attacking civilians, because he's not able to hit military targets. And the war at the front line has become a real war of attrition in which the Russian casualties are staggeringly high. Just unbelievable. Like they lose in a month what the Americans were losing in a year at the height of the Vietnam War. That can't be sustainable. Putin's overplayed his hand in the negotiations. He was offered a sweet deal that would have given him the Crimea, plus a substantial part of Donbass, a commitment to keep Ukraine out of NATO, and he walked away saying he wanted all of Ukraine. I gather that when they last spoke, Trump gave him a 55-minute earful. And so Putin has overplayed his hand, and that is good news. I think those who were worried that the United States would summarily throw Zelensky under a bus, which seemed to be on the cards when Zelensky was in the Oval Office being humiliated, now realize that things have taken a turn for the better. But I don't think we can count on Putin to oblige us by dying. Stalin's dying allowed us to end the Korean War. Maybe impossible to end the war in Ukraine until Putin does the same, but I just can't give you a date. I wish I could. Derek, another question, please. The yellow card is moving. I'll leave it to you, Derek. You choose. You have the yellow card.
Thank you. Thank you for an amazing talk. At Princeton, when we wrote a paper, we had to sign our names at the bottom with a honor code to attest that our work was our own. And given what you said today, it seems that no student's going to be able to do that anymore. And if they're not able to do that, when do the parents say we're not prepared to spend $500,000 over 4 years to educate our children?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry for your loss and that you went to Princeton. To be serious, the honor code of undergraduates, the UCLA graduation ceremony happened in what appeared to be a vast baseball arena. And at one point, one of the overachieving Asian students who was, I guess, announced as summa cum laude, at the moment of that announcement, took out his laptop and showed that his work was the work of ChatGPT. And everyone went crazy, delirious applause from his classmates. There is no honor code. Maybe at West Point there still is. There is no honor code amongst today's Gen Z undergraduates. They all cheat. They all cheat. And the only way to stop them cheating is to make it impossible, as we do at Oxford. And the way you do it is you say, this is the examination schools. Not only are you going to have to dress up in evening dress, but you are going to be cut off from all technology for the next 3 hours. You will have to write 3 essays, and we will then mark them entirely unaware of who you are, hoping that we can read your handwriting. That's the only solution. There is no other way to do this. So the return of traditional teaching methods is the only answer. That is not to say we prohibit access to large language models. We don't do that. My view is that when they're not in the cloister, they will be in what I call the starship, and we should want them to be in the starship. The thing about large language models is it's all about the prompt. It's all about how you ask the question. Stupid cheaters who haven't learned to think don't ask good questions. So if you've been in the cloister for 6 or 7 hours and then your access to ChatGPT or actually the superior models is granted, you will probably make good use of them. But I see no other solution but a return to the classical exam. And that's what we're pursuing in Austin. We're also insisting on no devices in the classroom so that there can be uninhibited, uninterrupted concentration and regular oral tests in class to make sure that people are in fact doing the work. And you would be amazed how little effort is being made at the established universities, including Princeton, which I know quite well because I have friends who teach there, to respond to this revolution that has now been going on for years. Because when is ChatGPT launched? N22 or is it 23? Not long ago, but instantly adopted by students and instantly used for any assignment that you can take home. And if you hear these things from places like Harvard, we're going to have a strict policy that you can't use AI for this and that. And that's the honor code problem right there, because those policies are just laughed at by the kids. We know this has been happening for a while because surveys of what students do all day, where they ask people, you know, how do you spend your day? Those surveys have shown the amount of time spent studying declining to the point that it's very hard to know what they do all day, except maybe they're all asleep, more likely just playing large language computer games. I'll take another question. There's a yellow rectangle right up there. Yes, please.
My partner is Taiwanese, and I have no sympathy at all with the CCP. But prior to being a Japanese colony, Taiwan was part of China, as then was. And I don't get any sense of any violent determination to defend themselves at the end. I get the feeling that they're trying to manage their way through the crisis. So do you really think it's possible to prevent Taiwan from being reabsorbed into China?
I know Taiwan much less well than you and your partner. It's certainly not Ukraine. I mean, I said to somebody a few years ago, the last place in the world I would want to get into a pub fight would be in Ukraine. I mean, Ukrainian guys are not, they're not shy. They're hard. They're hard. Taiwan would be my first choice for a pub fight. Because, you know, I look like an action hero compared with the average Taiwanese in a tea room. So it's hard to imagine tremendous resistance fighting in the streets. But it's also not clear how well the PLA would do if they attempted a very difficult thing like an amphibious invasion. PLA does good propaganda movies, but when did it last fight? Nobody in the PLA today has seen combat. So this would be a very different thing from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I'll give you a scenario, see what you think. I think this is likely to happen at some point in the next 3 years. China will not invade. It won't blockade. It'll simply say, from now on, because Taiwan is part of China, we're going to collect the customs, and we're sending Coast Guard vessels to do that, okay? And then in the Situation Room, President Trump will be sitting there, and Raisin Kane of the Joint Chiefs will be there, and Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, will be there, and they will have a very difficult conversation because there will be two possibilities, two choices. Option one, authorize Admiral Paparo, who's commander of Indo-Pacific Command, to take action against the Chinese vessels. Sam Paparo was a Top Gun pilot. He's an Irish-American. He would also do well in a pub fight in Ukraine. And he can't wait to do, he calls it Hellscape. Americans are good at these things. Operation Hellscape is the all-out drone destruction of Chinese naval vessels off Taiwan. So that's option A. This is also known as World War III. Jim Stavridis wrote a book about this. If this happens, it escalates real fast, because the Chinese will then probably try to take out U.S. communications on Guam, which they can do with hypersonic missiles, and then all hell breaks loose. This would be the biggest war since 1945, be the biggest naval battle since Midway. That's option A, Mr. President. Trump is looking a little unwell at this point. What's option B? Option B is you concede and you let China control Taiwan. There is no third possibility at this point, other than to try and avoid this showdown through a combination of diplomacy, sanctions, and the threat of force, which I think is the policy that is now going to be pursued. I think it's already being pursued. You need a deal to avoid a Taiwan semiconductor crisis, because it would be as risky as the Cuban Missile Crisis. Cuban Missile Crisis was nearly World War III. It was extraordinarily close to being World War III. Why would we want to risk that again? Particularly when this time the island is off the other superpower's coast, not the US coast. Therefore, the US would be in the position of the Soviet Union in 1962. And I've been saying for the last 10 years to three successive administrations, why would you want the president to be Khrushchev? Why would you want to put the president in the position where the choice is World War III or humiliation? So that's how I think this will play out. And you should expect negotiations between the US and China to continue to be about much more than tariffs. My own recommendation would be try to restore the compromise of 71-72, which is essentially, we continue to pretend that Taiwan is part of China, and you continue to ignore that it is an autonomous democracy that you do not control. That worked pretty well for 50 years. And there's no obvious reason in my mind why it shouldn't work for another 50 years, provided there is prudent diplomacy now. We have 4 minutes, 53 seconds. Where has the yellow card with Derek right at the back? Yes, please.
So Malthus, one of the great economists of history, was convinced that overpopulation would bring down Britain and Europe with it. Yet today, through a very low fertility rate, Britain and the rest of the Western world, and indeed China, are facing a birth crisis, basically. What measures do you think we can take to try and prevent this? Is it too late? And what do you see happening in the immediate future and in the long term? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I've had 5 children. What's your plan? My solution has been delivered. You've asked a great question. And it's a reminder that when economists and social scientists make predictions, you should pour yourself a stiff scotch, listen carefully, and then hit delete. Because these grand projections have been wrong more than once. Malthus said that in the end, population increases geometrically, the production of food arithmetically, therefore the only outcome of rising population will be famine and other forms of misery. And the Industrial Revolution was happening as he was writing. Solving the problem by increasing rapidly the production of everything, but including food. Fast forward to the 1960s and 70s, and it's the same guys from the same discipline saying, the population bomb, it's coming. There's going to be a Malthusian crisis. People like Paul Ehrlich were making this argument, and it persisted, this argument, right the way through. Now, Matt Connolly has a great book on this, showing how this led to horrific policy interventions in human reproduction, not only in China, but also in India and elsewhere. And here we are. It's the 2020s, and the demographers, as they revise the figures down, discover that peak humanity is probably just a couple of decades away. And it's only a couple of decades away because fertility rates are still above replacement. You know the replacement rate is 2.1 live births per woman. I don't know what happens to those 0.1 people. I think they go to Cambridge, don't you? That collapse in the rest of the world has consistently surprised the demographers so that they keep having to revise downwards the likely future populations, especially of the East Asian countries. China is not the worst. Oddly enough, Taiwan has one of the lowest fertility rates of any country in the world right now. So the Taiwanese, also the South Koreans, and the Chinese have essentially decided to go extinct. Because if you have a fertility that's close to 1, it's basically a plan to liquidate yourselves as a people, which is remarkable. I remember when I got to know Elon Musk more than 10 years ago, and one of the first conversations we had was about this population collapse, because I remember asking, what is the thing that worries you the most? And he said, population collapse. And as so often, he was ahead of the game. I have to wrap here, because we have 50 seconds left, and there's a man in a suit giving me the look. I know that look. I began with science fiction and history. Again, 20 years ago, if the book that you had been reading had said, the population of China fell by half between 2025 and the end of the 21st century, you would have thought that was wildly exaggerated. But the chances are it will fall by more than that because that's the median United Nations projection based on an assumption that the fertility rate will slightly go up. If I had another hour instead of just 12 seconds, I would love to tell you why I think so many people in the world are having just one child and some none, when the single most valuable thing, the most precious thing that I have done in my life, not to write books, it's been to have children. It's been to be a father. And I would say to you, young person, whatever you may be told by your contemporaries, who, because of climate change, we shouldn't bring any more people into the world, just like tell them to shut the hell up and focus on finding somebody who shares my enthusiasm for human reproduction. Thank you all very much indeed.